Hello, folks. Jeff Salzman here, and welcome to the Daily Evolver Live. It's Tuesday evening, March 4th, 2014, and I am happy to have you with us tonight. I'm here in Boulder, Colorado, with my assistant, Brett Walker, on tech. And tonight, I want to look at a couple stories. I want to start with a look at what's been happening in the Ukraine, and just some integrally informed insights that I think I have on that. And then later in the call, I want to bring on Michael Zimmerman. A lot of you know who he is. He's an integralist from way back, the co-author of Integral Ecology. And he's done a lot with Integral Life, who sponsors this Daily Evolver, by the way. He's done a lot of on Integral Life with artificial intelligence. And we have talked on the show a good bit about artificial intelligence, and particularly in reference to the movie Her, which is popular and been popular over the last few months. So we'll do that later in the show. So I want to start with a few insights from the conflict that's going on in the Ukraine. And again, I'm going to be using the basic integral map in terms of the evolution of consciousness, or the evolution into the altitudes of development, and also the quadrants, that is the interiors and exteriors. And so if you're interested in following along, there's a link on the bottom of your reminder email that will show you two charts that you might want to look at as we discuss various issues on this call that just sort of help, I think, place things and help you understand them better. Okay. So the first insight that I would offer on the Ukraine is that currently, at least, it's a lot of bluster. It's a lot of what basically superpowers, at least, do with each other these days, and that is hurl insults and say, you don't understand me. And in some ways, it has more of a flavor of a bad marriage than it does of arch enemies. And I think of Putin's press conference today, of Kerry and the Ukraine today, and, you know, just a lot of talking past each other. But I would point out that talking past each other is better than shooting past each other. And so far, both sides are eschewing violence, despite the fact that Putin has, in the words of the State Department, conducted a uncontested incursion, which is, I guess, different than a revolution, or an invasion, rather, into the Crimea. And one of the things that is most interesting to me about this is even looking at the hawks in America, and I'm talking the John McCains and, you know, in academics, I'm talking Neil Ferguson and, of course, Bill Kristol and, you know, basically the right wing, Dick Cheney, Sean Hannity, those folks, nobody's really advocating that we do any kind of a military counterforce, maybe a show of force. Certainly economic sanctions, try to get Georgia, fast-track Georgia into NATO, some things like that, bring back the nukes into Czechoslovakia. But nobody's advocating for actual boots on the ground or any kind of a military strike on the part of America, and that's significant. And I think really basically pretty good state of affairs. One of the things that basically all sides agree on is that Americans are war-weary. And, you know, they point to the fact that we've had two wars going on here now for since 2003, so going on 11 years now, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, not to mention Libya and some other incursions here and there, and that it's been a huge cost to America in terms of both lives and treasure. And, of course, the war on terror as a whole, I'm talking again Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, just, you know, various incursions, have cost over 6,800 American lives. And it's cost, you know, I've heard estimations of $1 trillion to, Bill Maher was talking about $4 trillion on his show the other night. I don't know where he got that number, but a lot of money. So if we put that in context, 6,800 American lives, let's compare that to Vietnam. Vietnam cost 60,000 American lives. And World War II cost 400,000 American lives. These are round numbers. And in the case of World War II, this is out of a population 100 million persons smaller in the country. And of course, we can always go back to the Civil War, which I often do because I just find it so astonishing that 2% of the population of the country was killed in that war, not just soldiers, the population at large, including slaves. It would be the equivalent of a war where 6 million people died today, not 6,800. In a way, it's hard to talk about. This is sort of the green in us that finds it's hard to talk about, well, we only lost 6,800 people, so it's not as bad. Because we want to stay in touch with the fact that for every one of them, it was, you know, completely consequential. It was the end of their life. And true of all of them, their families and their kids and their spouses and their parents, and it's a tragedy all around. But it's a small, relatively small, I figured it out, it's 0.002%, 0.001 of a percent, as opposed to 2% in the Civil War, of the population lost to the War on Terror. And two, in terms of treasure, military spending is currently somewhere between 4 and 5% of the gross domestic product of the United States. That's military spending, between 4 and 5%. In 1944, during World War II, it was 38%. And so, again, relatively speaking, it's far less onerous to be at war. Now, not to mention the fact that these wars are not fought by draftees, which, of course, the World War II and the Vietnam War were both fought by draftees. But these are professionals. These are people who are, you know, soldiers. The people drawn to the military are generally the professionals are kind of an amber orange. They have a lot of sense of duty to country. They're actually serious about making a career out of it. These are, you know, good, hardworking people. They're all good, hardworking people. But the other, if you will, integral address that is drawn to the military are young warriors. And these are usually young men who are, you know, amber red, and they're a healthy red. They're actually, they like to fight. They like to be in a deep soldierly camaraderie with other men. And this can be healthy or unhealthy, but it generally, I always love a quote from George Orwell. He said, "People sleep peaceably in their beds at night only because rough men stand ready to do violence on their behalf." So, in a way, our military in the United States is, actually not as onerous as by far than it's been in the past. And it turns out that Americans aren't as war-weary as much as they are orange and green. And they're modern and postmodern in their thinking. And that just has far less tolerance for war, far less interest in war. By the time you get to modernity, in terms of consciousness, in terms of the interiors, if you will, there's no longer the sense that conquering another group is going to be of any benefit. I mean, we just know too much. We know where that leads. We know what it costs. And so the move forward is to work with other people and in terms of alliances and so forth. And that's really leads me to the second insight about what's going on in the Ukraine. And then this is from an American perspective particularly, but perhaps also from other parts of the world, Europe particularly. But just the reflexive demonization in the media of the Russians and particularly Vladimir Putin. And as I said, what's motivating Putin, you hear the critique from the right, from like John McCain, he says, Putin wants to restore the Russian Empire. That's his ambition. Well, there's a certain truth to that, in that Putin does want to create a sphere of influence with cultures and countries that have been in the sphere of the Russian influence for a long time, and particularly the Soviet influence, which was, you know, 70 long years. And there's an enmeshment that happens, and that he would want to have countries in that sphere of influence in terms of trade, in terms of employment for Russians, in terms of protecting Russians. This all makes perfect sense to Vladimir Putin. And it doesn't necessarily make him a megalomaniac. It may be that he is, But you don't have to be a megalomaniac to be doing what Putin's doing. I think what Vladimir Putin is, first and foremost, is he's a Russian nationalist, as are a lot of Russians. And nationalists are, to the degree that they're blue or amber, to the degree that they're traditionalists, they think they are in a fundamental way the chosen people, and that in an ideal world, they would rule everything. That's just the way traditionalists think. I often point to Dick Cheney as an example of that kind of thinking in America, and point out to my liberal friends who just instinctively hate him, and the liberal in me instinctively hates him, but point out that Dick Cheney is trying to create a better world for his grandchildren, you know, by his own lights. So is Vladimir Putin. And so are nationalist Russians. So they're, you know, they need to be understood in that light. It doesn't do much good to, you know, the way we laugh at Putin and how he, I was reading in CNN about how he was at the end of the Olympic ceremonies, he was up in the stands smirking. It's like, well, maybe. I mean, he was probably smiling, but was he smirking? I mean, smirking is a projection of the interior on another person and an interpretation. It's not actually what is going on. But this is what happens when we demonize other people. We see it in our own lives. I mean, we don't only hate what they think and what they're doing. We hate how they chew their food. We hate how they brush their teeth. And so this, you know, and then we see Putin riding around shirtless and his testosterone pumped body and, you know, all this plastic surgery and so forth. But as integralists, we actually want to get in the head of Vladimir Putin. We actually want to get into the head of the nationalist Russians. You know, we hear, particularly from the right, about how Putin can't be trusted, and the Russians can't be trusted, but particularly Putin can't be trusted. And I think from an integral perspective, we just look at trust a little bit differently. It's not that we trust that somebody, think of this even in your own life, with somebody that you may have some struggles or conflict with, and you think, I can't trust them. Well, perhaps you can't trust them to do what they say. Perhaps you can't even trust them to mean it when they say what they're going to do. But you can trust them to be who they are. And so we trust Putin to be Putin, a Russian nationalist who has his people's interests, and particularly his Russian people, the ethnic Russians, deeply at heart, and is trying to create a space in the world for them to thrive and exercise their power and influence and to express their Russianness. And so we trust them to do that. And like all nationalists, they're going to prevaricate and they're going to, you know, spin, and they're going to get away with what they can, and so we trust them to do that. And then we also want to, in terms of trust, we want to be able to trust that whatever Putin does, we can respond to it. And I think that's pretty clear. I mean, nobody is going to want to go to any kind of significant war here in this situation. Most people think that Putin's bottom line is that he wants to keep the base, naval base that Russia has in Sevastopol, which is in the Crimea in southern Ukraine. He wants to keep that safe. And that there will be some sort of a soft annexation, is what they call it in diplomacy, where Russia pulls certain political strings, economic strings, military levers, all of which fall short of a traditional invasion, and get as much influence as he can. And I don't think he necessarily knows what that means yet. I think, you know, as in all games, we play by play. But I think as integralists, we actually do want to, you know, make it our job to resist the reflexive demonization of the other. It's the very first tier, you know, and we really want to be second tier. I love what Putin said in the press conference today. He said, the United States government is interfering in the Ukraine from across the pond in America as if they were sitting in a laboratory and running experiments on rats without any understanding of the consequences. And again, that's just so much like, you know, you just don't understand me. And so we want to actually try to do that. And I think that Obama is actually. I mean, you hear from the right that Obama is feckless and weak, and this leading from behind idea just drives the right crazy. But that Obama is actually kind of just sort of laying back in a way. It's not a bad idea. I think it's actually a great idea, particularly in the sense that we're not in the middle of this in the same way that the Europeans are, and we Americans. Ukraine is being pulled between the West, the sphere of influence of the West, and the sphere of influence of the Russians. I think most Ukrainians want to go with the West, even in these Russian areas, apparently. The majority of people, even the majorities of ethnic Russians. And this is something, they want to align themselves more with the West than with Russia. And this is where, you know, Putin ultimately loses, because he's not as modern as the West. The West is modern, postmodern. Particularly younger people want to get in that game. They want to be part of the world. They don't want to be part of what's happening in Russia, which is feels like, you know, a lot of, remember our conversation with Viktor Shchenko. You know, this really very confused conglomeration of oligarchs and red power structures and a lack of amber, and it's a bit of a mess. And that, you know, that Putin is in the catbird seat, which is what we hear from the right-wing critics, that, you know, Putin's, you know, won this one. He's playing chess and Obama's playing tiddlywinks. I just don't get it. I mean, he just lost. He just lost the Ukraine, basically. I mean, his guy, Yanukovych, was run out of town and left. And, you know, if we interpret that as, you know, Putin's getting his way, it's just, well, it's just what traditionalists do. And that's the right wing. And I'm talking even, you know, people like Bill Kristol, very smart people, Neil Ferguson, you know, Oxford, you know, very, very intelligent people. Temperamentally or developmentally, actually, they're a traditional, which is not an opinion, actually. It's a way of thinking. It's the way the brain and the wiring and the software, if you will, of the brain has come online in terms of development. And we call the traditional stage of development in terms of mental functioning the absolutistic stage of development. Because the job of traditionalists is to civilize the previous stage of development, which was basically red or power, might is right, chaos. And so for people to civilize those basically impulses, to become more civilized, you know, Ten Commandments, don't steal your neighbor's wife, don't kill each other, that sort of thing. To do that requires a significant move forward. And it also requires seeing the world in terms of black and white, and that there has to be an enemy. And if you're not seeing the enemy, and if you're not engaging the enemy, if you really want to get a sense of how traditionalists see the enemy, think of Satan, you know, literally. Think of the devil, wily, always plotting, two steps ahead, can't believe anything. And above all, this world, this life, is not about compromising with the devil. It's about fighting and defeating the devil. And that's just, you know, the animating energetic of the absolutistic mindset. And it's not the energetic of the modern and postmodern mindset. I was listening to Bill Kristol, actually, on Morning Joe this morning, and he said this idea that Obama would try to find, you know, give Putin a face-saving exit and try to, you know, sort of fudge things and smooth things over and not bring them to a head is a huge mistake, because Vladimir Putin needs to be humiliated. He needs to be weakened domestically by having his head handed to him for doing this. And Obama needs to do that. Now, how, you know, is not so clear. But that's the thinking. That's the mindset of the traditionalist. And here's the mindset, I think, of an integralist. And this is a paragraph I'm going to read from Fareed Zakaria's column on how basically Obama in the West is playing this Ukraine thing pretty well, which I agree with. And he says, first of all, the United States is not the most important player in the crisis. Ukraine wants to be part of the European Union, and it is the European Union that will make the crucial set of decisions that will affect the fate of Kiev. Parentheses, that's why Washington was understandably frustrated with the Union's slow and fitful diplomacy, as evidenced in Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland's profane phone criticism, where she said, fuck the European Union, because they were kind of dilly-dallying with the Ukraine, in her opinion. But Fareed Zakaria goes on. He says, by staying relatively quiet and working behind the scenes, the Obama administration ensured that the story was not about America's plans to steal Ukraine from Russia, but rather about the Ukrainian people's desire to move west. Nationalism, that crucial force, is not working against U.S. interests for a change. Now the United States can play a key role in helping to deter Russia from derailing Ukraine's aspirations. That will require some firmness, but also careful negotiations, not bluster. And I think that's pretty much right. And then the first thing was the idea of war weariness, and that basically we've so lowered the bar in terms of war weariness and when we get to modernity, which is a good thing. I'm all for lowering that bar. I mean, we want to get progressively more weary with less and less war. So that's one thing. The second thing is this reflexive demonization of Putin and what to do instead. And third is to bring to this whole thing that don't know mind that I've talked about before. And just the idea that we can watch our mind try to clench around what we think's right and wrong and who's right and wrong and what we should and shouldn't do and how things are all going to hell, and just watch our mind as it tries to clench around some opinion and some ideology around this, and to, you know, breathe through it, as they say, come back to some other objective meditation and let it dissolve. Because we actually don't know. I'm not sure Putin knows or Obama knows. You know, these things unfold in real time. And if we can unclench from our, you know, really hardened conditioned opinions, then it allows us to stay open to what's actually happening and helps us to see it with unconditioned eyes and mind. And, you know, and this is the great teaching of Buddhism, is that when we do that, it allows us to have compassion for all the players. Putin, nationalists, Ukrainians, the people in Maidan Square, everybody. And not an idiot compassion that just says, oh, you're okay. But a compassion that doesn't enable ignorant behavior to continue and that actually works skillfully and has a chance of working skillfully with all of the things that I think the West is now contemplating. You know, luring the Ukraine with big loans. I think John Kerry offered $1 billion today. And, you know, membership of the EU, sanctions against Russians. I think these are all day-by-day moves. And we can watch and hold a certain space of wisdom and compassion that actually might even be helpful, in the sense that to the degree that we build these grooves in the cosmos through thinking about them, through thinking integrally, that's, I think, to the good. All right, so those are my thoughts on the Ukraine. If anybody has any comments or questions, you can press 1. Also, I wanted to point out that on dailyevolver.com, my website, my blog, we put a little orange tab on the right side that says, send a voicemail. And now you can, just using your computer, no phone needed, you can send me a voice message with a question or comment that I could address on the call, future calls. And there's also the same button on the Daily Evolver Facebook page called SpeakPipe. Okay, so now I want to turn our attention to another topic, and this is this idea of, it's gotten so much kind of attention, the call that we did on Her, which is, of course, the movie by Spike Jonze that got a lot of Academy Award nominations. I'm not sure it won any. But it's about Joaquin Phoenix, a man who, about 20, 30 years in the future, falls in love with his operating system, played by Scarlett Johansson. And just, you know, what happens. It's, you know, in some ways, a classic romantic comedy about two people who love each other but can't get together because of things beyond their control. You know, it's a sort of a classic thing, but really very interesting and very different. And my critique of the movie was that I don't think that you can create interiors out of exteriors. So it's sort of, you know, theoretically the movie didn't make sense to me. So, you know, it doesn't matter how many, how complex your computer is, how complex your computer program is, it's not going to throw off any interiority. So I got a lot of blowback from that, and I'm not sure I'm right, but it's good conversation, I think. And one of my favorite conversation partners around this and a lot of things is my dear brother, Michael Zimmerman, who lives here in Boulder. He's a professor at CU, a professor of philosophy, and has really been with Integral, the Integral movement, since the beginning, and with Integral Institute seminars that we did for all those years. And he contributes a lot on Integral Life. And his specialty, and one of his special areas of interest, is this area of artificial intelligence, just what we've been talking about, and transhumanism. And he has posted on Integral Life a range of articles from an integral look at super artificial intelligence to integral thinking and cutting-edge neurophysiology to a four-part series on the singularity. And the singularity, of course, is when machines become intelligent, including religious motifs in technological posthumanism, and my favorite, last man or overman, transhuman appropriations of the Nietzschean theme. So I'm happy to have Michael join me tonight. Michael, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me, Jeff. And by the way, I love that, everything you said about the Ukraine. I think that is right on. You should be writing a column for the New York Times to get those people's heads on right.
It's about time we straighten these people out.
That's it. Michael. Really, it was great. Well, I was totally on board.
Oh, thanks, man. It's fun and very fulfilling to do this kind of work.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things we do in this call is we look at politics and we look at war and peace and issues like the Ukraine, but we also look at culture. And this movie, Her, which has really gotten a lot of attention in the integral world because, you know, who can argue, even me? I can argue with the fact that it's about evolution and about how this computer program, this Samantha, played by Scarlett Johansson, evolves in real time through the movie. And so, you know, that's pretty thrilling. And yet, you know, my complaints about interiors and exteriors. And so I guess I just stop there and ask you to maybe straighten me out on this and see what you're thinking.
Well, you know, it really is complicated. I mean, first of all, no one knows if we'll be ever be able to create, you know, autonomous, self-conscious artificial intelligence. It's up in the air, so we don't know yet. But one of the things that we talk about in the integral world is the emergent phenomena that arise out of growing complexity. I mean, that's what the quadrant diagram is, isn't it? You see the Big Bang, and then you have all these various stages, and as you get more complex, you get greater depth, but less significance, right? I mean, the foundation is below us, but we're the cutting edge in a way. But it's all about complexity. If you have a super complex brain like humans have, you have a really rich interiority. So the supposition on the part of the AI people that whose work I read and so on is that that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to attain an analogous kind of complexity, which is very difficult, perhaps impossible to get, but something, you know, somewhat analogous to humans. I don't think we're ever going to be able to create human beings, I mean, except the old-fashioned way. But why not the possibility that non-carbon-based complexity could become self-conscious? The problem of how life got started on Earth is daunting, and even Darwin didn't try to explain it. And you know that Francis Crick of Crick and Watson, the DNA discoverers, Crick was so skeptical about life getting started on Earth, there wasn't enough time and not enough oceans, that he said that the planet was seeded from the outside with life, either accidentally or on purpose. That's what he ended up saying about it. So life is an incredibly complex conundrum, and we know, or at least we posit that in life, certainly there's something like interiority all the way down. And
yeah. Well, see, that's my point, is that where consciousness came from is that it was there at the beginning. Basically,
right.
The Big Bang brought into being a cosmos that consists of four quadrants, four dimensions,
right.
Four irreducible dimensions of reality, one of which is consciousness itself.
Or so interiority.
Actually, yeah, or interiority, or a sort of a proto-consciousness. So in other words, atoms are conscious in very, very small ways, just as they are
in a sense that they take into
a,
they take into account their environment in some way. I mean, that, so,
yes.
So then why not, if that's true, then why can't complex transistors and computer chips and so on, which are themselves have some kind of interiority, right? Because they're made of molecules.
The molecules have interior. The atoms have interiority. The molecules have interiority. And then when we get into life, the cells have interiority.
Right.
Because this is the stack of holons as we're moving up. And each stack of, each level of holon has all four quadrants.
Right.
But
so why not a new kind of holon coming up? Why are we stuck with those carbon-based holons?
We only get one holon? What's the matter?
I mean, at one time I think I would have just agreed, but I'm increasingly open to the possibility. What if part of the role, opportunity, mission of human beings is to keep creating beyond ourselves? And what if that would include the generation of a type of holon which would be analogous to the cell and organic life, but it would have a different type of makeup? It wouldn't look like us, wouldn't have a reptilian brain and sexual drive, and a lot of stuff would be missing, but there would be other things that would be present that we don't have access to just because it would be a very different type of entity. I mean, I'm just asking, why not? I mean, the claim that there only life has interiority, you yourself said, no, it goes all the way down. So why couldn't it show up in another way? Why does it have to be only terrestrial life, carbon-based terrestrial life that gets to be conscious in the way that we are? Why should that be the case? Can't we imagine another possibility?
A theoretical answer, a short one, would be because heaps of exteriors don't create interiors. And,
but they're not heaps.
But
they're not heaps. That'd be like saying you're just piling a bunch of transistors on top of one another, but that's not how computation works.
Yeah.
They're incredibly...
Here's a distinction. Let me put this distinction on the table,
right.
And we can see how we can work with this. So there's really two... I'm with you in this idea that God only knows what human beings are going to look like in 1,000 years. I mean,
sure.
I don't even want to know, tell you the truth.
Me neither.
I'm afraid. I'm afraid of that. But there's two ways that that can go. One is kind of a human plus. That is some sort of an augmented human where we would have... I just read in the New York Times. It was a big article about the ethics. A guy was very, very alarmed by the ethics of this... where they're planting DNA material from an egg into another woman's egg so that the child won't have some sort of a genetic disease. And
they took out the nucleus from the cell.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And so essentially then, the children born of this procedure will have the genetic material of three parents, not two.
Yes, I saw that. I remember that.
You know. And
yeah, that's
so,
pretty strange.
Yeah, that's pretty strange, and it's happening.
Yeah.
And even things like, that we have machines that can literally read thoughts and read images, at least, can move prosthetic limbs, that sort of thing. Where that goes, I don't actually have any problem with the idea that, as Ray Kurzweil said, that there will at some point be a facsimile of me that'll be so good that you could have a conversation with it, and it would sort of pass. Because it knows everything I've ever thought and everything I've ever said, and you can even touch it and get a sensory sense of touching me, and he talked about even making love, even though you're in two different kinds,
right.
But you have this device where you can sort of feel, and in terms of your own subjective perception.
Right. Well, that's what goes on in her with when they bring back Alan Watts.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
He's not embodied,
So just to spoil the movie for whoever hasn't seen it yet, Samantha, the computer program, as I said, literally continues to evolve until she's in, not only evolve, but evolve in terms of heart and consciousness to the point where she starts reading Alan Watts, which I think is very cool. You know, Alan Watts being the great, you know, American apologist, if you will, of Zen. I mean, he wrote the most wonderful books about Zen back in, I think, the 60s, 70s?
Right.
Yeah.
He was English, actually.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. And then eventually she gets to the point where she's identifying with the space between words, which is, you know, for anybody who's done any kind of study of the mystical traditions, that's that kind of talk is, you know, that's all over that.
Right.
So it was very cool. And then finally she just sort of blew away into sort of a, what would you say, non-being? Or you pointed it out, Michael, that it's a kind of like a dust or something.
Well, she becomes shunyata, emptiness.
Yeah.
She you remember that she said she was transcending the material plane. At first she said, well, we're both matter because everything comes out of the Big Bang, and she's a computer and program or whatever. But then she says she's transcended matter, which would in a sense mean she now is the open context within which phenomena arise or something. I mean, she's entered the highest possible space that Buddha speaks about. That's how I see the Alan Watts connection. That's what that seems to point to.
That's very cool.
Yeah, well, I've been teaching this philosophy and science fiction course for 4 or 5 years now, and it's really interesting to study films and read commentaries on them and so on. The more impressed I am by the sophistication and intelligence of these directors and screenwriters and so on. And this guy, Spike Jonze, is really super smart and gifted, and there's so much going on in the film. One reason I think it's so interesting is because there's this whole, you and I were chatting earlier, whole alternative way of reading the plot. It's not just about all the things we were talking about earlier, but it's also about Samantha as his muse. Theodore, you know, he is a brilliant writer of other people's feelings. You know, that's his job. He writes letters for other people, and he establishes long-term relationships with both the people for whom he's asked to write a letter and those to whom the letter's addressed. So he's got this rich second life going, but he's unable to write to his own ex-wife an honest letter until after Samantha, his muse, leaves him. He finally is able then to write the letter apologizing and for having hidden himself from her. He was unable to talk to her. Now he can because his muse has left him, and now he's got to own his own life. And then he finally goes up on the roof of that skyscraper, which I read where he lives as the pinnacle of human consciousness or human civilization. That's as far as we've gotten compared to Samantha, who's become nothingness, right? And then he laid, you know, Amy, his former college buddy, she leans her head onto his shoulder like these two. She lost her muse too. She's a computer programmer, and now they're going to get together because their hearts have been opened in a way. And Samantha facilitated that, and partly because she left. If she'd stayed on, they wouldn't have grown up.
Yeah. No, that's a lovely interpretation, and you and others have convinced me that I need not, you know, hate that movie as much as I thought I had to.
Well, I think it's beautiful in many ways. But now, look, I totally share your uncertainty and anxiety and resistance, whatever the term would be, would fit, you know, your considerations about this whole AI thing. I mean, if in fact, you know, consider who's behind the whole AI thing. I mean, how many Silicon Valley gurus, I mean, are really into interiority and integral thinking? I mean, to what extent are they approaching this whole thing from the exterior perspective?
Well, Kurzweil and all
of them. Get a good enough program, and then something will happen. But that's not well enough informed. There needs to
be. Well, you know, I think they're materialists, basically materialists through and through. And I think that's true of a lot of integralists. I think that that's just sort of the hangover of modernity and postmodernity. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily wrong. I think one of the things that modernity does is it wrings out, you know, this sort of black magic and superstition and, you know, all of this sort of magic of the interior.
Right.
You know, that's the job of modernity. And I think that's where a lot of integralists, but I think that really misses one of the really key insights that Ken had about, that it's not that the gross world kicked off the subtle world and that the subtle world kicked off the spiritual world. It's that those existed from the beginning. Right. And that's a radical thing. That's a radical change of the cosmology of the great chain of being.
Yeah.
And it means that there is a consciousness in the cosmos, and perhaps before the Big Bang, that is not creatable. It's workable, and it has certain sort of ways that it lives and shows up, and that it's not about complexity. That was the previous view of the world. And so as a result, a lot of integralists, you know, they'll sort of be able to think about a higher self. They'll be able to maybe even do some sort of rituals and worship, but it's not in the sense that there's actually a consciousness that is seeing me and loving me back. And that's very, very special. And that's you know, something I think that we could be growing into. I don't know.
You mean some kind of divine consciousness?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, that's, I'm attracted to that. You know, I was raised Catholic and dropped out in college for 10 years and became an atheist and studied Nietzsche. And then I read Be Here Now by Ram Dass, and you know, everything changed and all that, like millions of other people. But I go to Mass now, but I'm kind of a Catholic Buddhist with Jewish mysticism and some Hinduism, and you know, it's postmodern in some way. But one of the reasons I've never been fully satisfied with Buddhism, despite how attracted I am to it, is because it ends up with this impersonality, which seems there's something profoundly missing from that. Personality seems to be, should be a central feature of divinity in some level, or a central dimension of the nature of reality. Even if there are levels beyond personality, presumably God's not like personality in the same way that we are, that would have to be in there. And that's one of the things I miss from Buddhism. It doesn't really know what to do with it. It's so afraid of the, or has such considerations, not afraid, such considerations about selfhood because of the nature of greed and egotism and all that stuff, that it doesn't have a real good discourse about this. And that's why
I agree. I think of my Buddhist friends. I mean, they'll go as far as, you know, Buddha nature. There may even be a certain loving intelligence that is part of the creation. And, you know, they'll bump right up to it.
Right. Point in that direction, but they can't really go there. You know?
No, because they're, you know, central to the doctrine is non-theism. That's fine. No problem. I mean, they do first person unlike anybody on the planet. But second person, they don't do so well.
Right.
So that's why integral comes in handy, because this is an integration of both in, you know, a new way.
Right. Well, that reminds me then of the, you know, Ken Wilber's doing this whole fourth turning of the Wheel of Dharma coming up next month. And, you know, I've read some of the things he's been saying about it. I mean, I think it sounds terrific and it's needed. I think it's important. Now it would be interesting if this fourth turning involved second person too. I mean, that part of the, what would have to shift within Buddhism in the fourth turning, see, to allow a greater kind of resonance with this dimension of many other religious traditions? Because Buddhism's kind of an outlier. It's different from Hinduism and monotheism and so on. It is a very unusual gambit, if you will, in terms of religious experience, religious teaching.
Yeah.
And would the evolution of Buddhism include a different relationship to that second person issue?
Well, let me just say that if for those of you who are interested in that question, and Michael, you too, on Integral Life, Ken has a bunch of stuff regarding the fourth turning. as the, Diane Mushel Hamilton's on there. The conference that you're talking about, the Fourth Turning of Buddhism, will be in Denver, April 4th through the 6th, and you can check that out on Integral Life, too. But, yeah, very interesting stuff. And Michael, I see we have a question or comment, so let's just move into that and stay on, and we'll see how it goes.
Great.
So, Mary Linda, welcome.
Hey there, Jeff. Hi. This is such a great conversation. Thank you both for running the ending of Her for me. I haven't seen it yet.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Spoiler alert.
That's okay. Because I am loving what this movie's about, and I don't know why I haven't seen it, because I do enjoy, you know. But the reason I jumped on here with you in this conversation is that what you were talking about, that Samantha was his muse. And, you know, when I think about my 30, 40 years of meditation, you know, this is what I've discovered within me. You call it my muse, my soul, my higher self, but this greater, bigger, transcended self from, you know, the mere personality ego that now, you know, sustains me beautifully. It's beautiful. And I think this was the whole point. If I'm listening correctly to what you are both saying, is that, you know, this is what was happening. It would be the same thing as if what we discover in our own interiors, in our own evolution, you know, as we move into these higher stages of consciousness and we leap from first tier into second tier, something is happening.
Yeah.
We are merging. Something is coming forth. And it's much bigger than anything in first tier. We grew up there, so to speak, you know? But there's something bigger, and it is divine. It is more divine. I mean, I feel this. I look out into the world with new eyes. I hear new sounds. I touch with different feelings. It's phenomenal. And, you know, we're at the very, very, you know, just beginnings of this. Just the beginning.
No, it's really true. And if we think of the difference between, you know, traditionalist mind and modernist mind, and the difference between modernist mind and postmodernist mind, radically different receptors, radically different ways of seeing the world, radically different capacities. What's the next one, you know? How different is integral? And I think a lot of what you just said, Mary Linda, just about even the intensification of the senses and of a certain wisdom and what we find in our own higher selves and what we find in our own psyche that's actually more intelligent than we are, it's the strangest thing, is some of what we're going to find. And Michael, any thoughts on that?
I love what you were saying there. I didn't catch your name. Please remind me.
Mary Linda.
Thank you, Mary Linda. I thought that was beautiful, the whole theme of the higher self. You discover your own muse, which is transcends the limits of our little egos and so on. And I do see a developmental process there, which getting us in touch with something more profound, something higher, something divine. I think that's widely understood by spiritual traditions, that that's the trajectory of the human, and that the more we open ourselves to that possibility, which is always a risk, because it means you're letting go of our, you know, our little life raft a little bit, the better, because we grow in that way, as you've been reporting. So I thought that was very nice. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, just to add one last thing, and then I think we'll just close up here. For me in my practice these days, my spiritual practice, the second person, this idea of a divine other, however you want to, you know, define that, is, so for instance, with this idea of a muse, I would work with seeing that muse, not as a part of myself, but as an actual other, ontologically other.
Yeah, I like that.
And assigned to me, you know, by the, you know, powers that be in this sort of whole cosmology of personality that I think the universe may have. I mean, I'm just playing with that idea that I can actually relate to some of these personalities. I often work with the idea that I've been assigned, you know, essentially guardian angels or sages or guides, and that they're not me. They're actually something other than me. And that it becomes a real second person, an I-thou relationship, rather than me, you know, working with it as if it were just a manifestation of myself. So, you know, just playing with that these days.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah. All right, Michael. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
More than welcome. Thank you very much, Jeff, for having me.
It's always a pleasure. Michael Zimmerman, again, this is a product of Integral Life. I mentioned that there's a lot of the information on the fourth turning is on the Integral Life website, that this full call will be posted on the Integral Life site. I think this is the 83rd or 84th of the Daily Evolver calls. So I'm really happy to be doing this work, happy to be with you. Thank you for listening tonight, and we'll check in next Tuesday night for another edition of the Daily Evolver Live. Bye, folks.